Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Hill against Lockhart. I think this will give us a chance to clear it up.
Really, it's a question of whether this text would authorize this exercise.
That seems to be the sensible way that it would work. Jesus, these courts have got this flow of stuff coming in, and if they can't change it,
they can come up as he said. At least four circuits, much more so than the sixth, fifth, and third half of the facts.
This is the that's the president of the important taxation of France, the little lady here. We're having a reception tonight. We see her in the box.
The lady is?
Mm-hmm. She's the president of the court. Mr. Lassiter, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the issue presented in Hill v. Lockhart is rather technical and narrow issue, but one I think that is significant in the daily workings of the criminal courts. Petitioner William Hill entered a guilty plea in the Pulaski County Circuit Court in 1979 to charges of murder and theft of property. He received a 35-year sentence on the first-degree murder conviction and a concurrent 10-year sentence on the theft of property conviction. In his habeas petition, which he filed pro se and which appears in the joint appendix at 8 and 9, he alleged that he pled with the understanding that he would receive a 35-year sentence and that he would be parole eligible after serving one-third of his sentence, less good time.
Well, what page does that appear at, Mr. Lester?
It's at 8 and 9 in the joint appendix. The petition for habeas corpus is set forth there.
Mine only goes to page
8 and 9.
Oh, 8 and 9. I thought you said
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Yeah, thank you.
He also indicated that his lawyer told him that the court would impose the 35-year sentence. He alleged that his lawyer told him that he would be out in 6 years if he stayed out of trouble. He alleged that he was not advised of Act 93, which rendered him parole ineligible until serving one half of his sentence, less good time, since he was a second offender.
Does he allege that he had told his lawyer all of his factual background so that his lawyer would know that Act 93 was applicable?
Justice Rehnquist, that does not appear in his pleadings. At a hearing, if we were granted a hearing in this matter, of course this is not in the record, but that would be his testimony.
But it wasn't his in his petition for habeas that we're reviewing here.
That's correct. Of course, our position is that if he didn't tell counsel, counsel should have inquired about that, that would be part of the diligence that counsel should demonstrate in defending one in a criminal case. And I think we could also demonstrate that at a hearing.
Does the record reflect that Mr. Hill understood when he entered the plea that had he gone to trial, he would serve half of whatever sentence was imposed?
No, the record does not reflect that. There was no advice from the court concerning potential parole eligibility if he pled or if he went to trial.
But the law in Arkansas at the time was that had he gone to trial, he would serve half of any sentence resulting from a conviction?
Regardless of whether he pled or went to trial, he would be parole ineligible until serving one half less whatever good time had accrued.
As I understand it, Mr. Lassiter, your client here does not make any claim that his guilty plea was not intelligent or knowing. It's a challenge to the assistance of counsel he received.
We allege voluntariness. We allege that the plea was not voluntarily entered.
By reason of erroneous advice from the lawyer?
That's correct.
No claim of erroneous advice from the court?
That's correct. And we also do not claim that the court was under a duty to advise petitioner as to potential parole eligibility. We don't make that claim. We make the claim that his counsel affirmatively misadvised him. That is, he told him that he would be parole eligible at serving one-third less good time, that he told him that that would be about 6 years if he stayed out of trouble, that he would not have entered the plea except for that advice, that he would not have entered the plea if he had known that he would not be parole eligible until serving one-half less good time.
Mr. Lassiter, who was the lawyer now deceased?
His name was William Patterson. He was a deputy public defender.
Patterson?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Patterson died in the summer of 1980.
Would you mind explaining what the law in Arkansas is on alleging and proving prior convictions to enhance or determine parole eligibility? If I understand it correctly, the state is not required to allege and prove the prior conviction.
That's correct,
Your
Honor.
That's a determination to be made by the parole board after the conviction and sentence. Is that right?
It is determined by the Arkansas Department of Correction. When the inmate is received at the Department of Correction, they will check his prior record through the Arkansas Crime Information Center and the FBI. And then if they find a prior felony conviction for which he was incarcerated, then they use that in computing his parole eligibility date. The state does not have to allege and prove prior convictions as part of the trial process or plea process. The district court dismissed the petition without a hearing. The Eighth Circuit affirmed, the Eighth Circuit holding that details of parole eligibility are a collateral, not a direct consequence of the plea, and therefore cannot render Mr. Hill's plea involuntary. And also the Eighth Circuit looks at the Fourth Circuit cases of Strader versus O'Toole discussed in the brief and finds here that counsel's misadvice alleged does not rise to the level of gross misinformation as addressed in Strader and O'Toole. There's one matter here that I would like to address initially because the cases cited in the brief, a number of them distinguish between what we call positive misadvice and statements by counsel that are called a mere prediction or present only a hope of leniency. The state argues that in the situation that Mr. Hill found himself in and with the series of events as alleged by Mr. Hill, that counsel's advice here could only be of a speculative nature, just an estimate, and cannot rise to the level of being positive misadvice. And the state argues that that is so because under the Arkansas Rules of Criminal Procedure, the trial judge does not have to accept the recommendation of the state. Now, that is correct. Under the Arkansas Rules of Criminal Procedure, the trial judge does not have to accept the recommendation of the state. But we're not sure exactly what happened here. Mr. Hill alleged that counsel told him that the judge would accept the plea. Under the Arkansas Rules of Criminal Procedure, there is a provision which allows the attorneys to discuss the plea with the court beforehand, and the court can either accept or indicate that the court will accept or reject. That may have happened here. We're not sure. If we had a hearing this matter, I also think that I could show that this particular judge at that time in 1979 accepted almost all recommendations from the state on negotiated pleas, and it was his practice, if he was not going to accept that recommendation, to allow the defendant
well,
to
under this plea, the highest potential sentence that could have been imposed was up to 50 years. Is that correct?
5 to 50 or life at the time.
And had the judge given the maximum sentence, then this Mr. Hill would not have had to serve longer than the time he's objecting to here. Isn't that true? A a third of 50 would be how much? And how is he prejudiced then by the fact that he got a lesser sentence that he has to serve half of, which wouldn't be any more than had he received the maximum sentence and served a third of it?
Well, the allegation is that he entered the plea based on advice by counsel that he would receive the 35 years, and he did receive the 35 years, and that he relied on that in entering the plea. If he had received a 50-year sentence, then the same parole laws would have been in effect. He would have to have served one-half less good time and not one-third less good time, as counsel told him he would have to serve.
When the judge asked him whether any promises were made to him to get him to enter the plea agreement, his response was no, nothing that didn't appear in the agreement. Are you relying for purposes of this case on a promise that he would get 35 years maximum or not? Because that would be in conflict with the face of the plea agreement, and I hadn't understood that you had raised that or were relying on that. I understood that you were relying only on an allegation that the lawyer had told him something about his parole eligibility date. Not that he had been promised that he'd get a 35-year sentence maximum.
Well, I think I have to address the issue of what sentence that the lawyer told him he would get in order to demonstrate that the lawyer's advice concerning potential parole eligibility was not just an estimate or a prediction. If we were in the situation where nobody knew what Mr. Hill was going to receive when he walked up there and pled.
He didn't know what he was going to get. The judge wasn't bound. They could have given him 50 years.
He could have, but that was not that judge's practice. And counsel advised him that the court would impose whatever the recommendation was. That is correct. Under the Arkansas Rules of Criminal Procedure, the judge did not have to take the recommendation.
Let's assume he expected to get 35 years and the judge gave him 50. Would you think he would have some right to habeas corpus just based on that?
It depends on what happened beforehand. If it was a negotiated plea where the judge had in no manner whatsoever participated in it, and if counsel had not advised him that he was going to get 35 years, and he walked up there and the judge gave him 50 years, no, he wouldn't have any claim.
Mr. Lassiter, you keep changing the question. Now, I'm looking at the question presented for review to this court, and I read it as saying that he alleges that the attorney misadvised him as to his potential parole eligibility date, not that he had been promised he would get a 35-year maximum
sentence. That's correct, John. That's a question.
So you're arguing something now that I didn't understand was encompassed in this question at all. I understood you were basing it on an allegation that the lawyer said you're going to be eligible for parole after serving a third of your sentence, whatever it is.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's the question presented.
So we don't have to consider this discussion this morning about a promise of 35-year maximum, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. I only mentioned that in trying to show that we have positive misadvice here and that we're not dealing with speculation.
In the habeas petition, Mr. Lassiter, did your client make the contention that had he been properly advised as to parole eligibility, he would not have entered into this plea bargain?
Your Honor, he does not in his habeas petition. That does appear, however, in the objections to the proposed order of the magistrate, and that's at it appears it, that is in the joint appendix. At 46 and 47.
Is it your argument that the Constitution requires that in plea bargaining and in the hearing before the trial court that there always is a right, a constitutional right, to know the earliest date at which parole may be considered?
No, Your Honor. We're not arguing that. I'm not arguing that. I am arguing that the Constitution places a duty on the attorney to advise properly when he does that and to not overlook an easily accessible published statute that controls parole eligibility. That's what we argue.
Let me ask one other, a factual question. You indicated that the basis for the claim that he would not have entered into the plea if he'd known the true facts is in your objections rather than in the habeas. And I know that's apparently, though, that's a document which you prepared. It's not under oath.
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor.
I mean, there's no way you could testify to this. So is it proper, in your view, for the record to be made up of, in effect, factual statements in a brief in support of your position? That's the nature of what it is.
Well, you take it as it is. He prepared his pro se petition. He was not a lawyer. He's not a scholar. I came in after the magistrate had prepared his recommendations for the district court, and then I filed the objections. I can only at this point tell the court what his testimony would be.
One other fact kind of puzzles me a little bit. I guess for Act 93 to apply, there has to have been a prior felony conviction, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it clear that the lawyer who is now deceased was advised about the existence of the prior felony conviction?
Not in the record.
So you really don't know if the lawyer did anything but tell him, according to his best knowledge, what the law was. I'm just speculating because you, in answer to Justice O'Connor, you point out that the correction office checks this at the time of parole eligibility.
That's correct.
But apparently the judge thought it was a third. It doesn't seem to be anybody was conscious of the prior conviction as far as I can tell.
Again, as I said a moment ago, I think counsel is under a duty to inquire about prior convictions, even if we had a situation here where petitioner didn't tell him. And also, let me address the...
See, the thing, just one other observation. The lawyer who is now deceased and apparently died just shortly before the habeas corpus petition was filed, apparently, if he was a public defender, I'm amazed that he wouldn't know about Act 93, but I could understand how he might not know about a prior conviction.
Yes, it surprises me also.
Mr. Lassiter, couldn't your client have amended his habeas corpus petition if at the time of you were objecting to the magistrate's report, it appeared to you that it had not said enough on the subject of whether he would have entered this plea had the advice been correct?
I believe that he could, and as I say, I raised that in the objections to...
But it's not in any verified way.
That's
you certainly can't speak for him.
Well, that would be my error if that was not done.
We really don't know then, by his statement, we don't know that he would not have entered exactly the same plea even if he had received the correct advice.
Not based on the allegations that appear in the original petition, I think
that
is correct. Well,
not based on any other statement by him in the record. Isn't that correct?
It does not appear at page 89 in his allegations. Justice Stevens, you raised a question a moment ago concerning what the court said about the defendant being required to serve one-third. I'd like to clear this up if there's some misunderstanding about that. Whatever the circuit court judge would have said at that time would have had no effect on the potential parole eligibility date of the petitioner. That was strictly controlled by Act 93. And that would have been set once he reached the Department of Correction. I believe that was probably just a result of habit at that time. Some of the judges continued to do that because prior to the enactment of Act 93, if one was under the age of 21, and he would be immediately parole eligible upon being sentenced to the Arkansas Department of Correction as a first offender, and the judge could make him serve one-third less good time by saying he had to serve a third. So I think that was just from force of habit. His statement that he was to do one-third would have had no effect whatsoever on the amount of time that he was to serve.
Mr. Lassiter, assuming that the court were to feel that the allegations somehow rose to the level that a hearing would be appropriate, what standard should be applied to determine, what legal standard should be applied to determine the ineffectiveness of assistance claim in a plea bargain situation?
I think we can take Strickland v. Washington and place it on this situation and ask, first of all, was counsel diligent in his representation of the defendant? Did he breach some duty owed, some investigatory duty or some other duty owed to the defendant? And we would ask that question first. Petitioner would testify.
Or perhaps ask first whether there was prejudice.
Of course, that's the second prong of the test, and the prejudice here would be that he would not have entered the plea except for this advice and that he waived his right to go to trial.
If the facts appeared that he had made such an allegation.
Yes, of course.
May I ask one other? I'm sorry to take so much of your time, but your brief refers to the previous Florida conviction. Where in the record do we know exactly what the Florida conviction was for and when it was entered?
It doesn't appear.
It does not appear?
No, I don't.
Well, is it conceivable, I'm not suggesting this happened, that the defense counsel knew about the Florida conviction, but the prosecutor and the judge didn't, and he thought it'd be a little smarter not to mention it? Is that possible, consistent with what we know in the record?
It's possible, but it would have been very ill-advised because the Department of Correction would have caught it once he arrived there.
Yes, but on the other hand, maybe if they'd known, I don't know what that conviction was. It might have been something that might have made the prosecutor ask for a more severe sentence. That's what I just don't know. And we're if you get a hearing that you ask for, the testimony will be presented by your client about his conversation with a now-deceased lawyer. It's kind of an unsatisfactory state of affairs.
I would have to assume that again, we're speculating here, but I would have to assume that the prosecutor was aware of that because routinely they run an FBI check on people that are charged with serious
crimes.
Well,
is it your suggestion the prosecutor didn't know about Law 93 either? If he knew about it, I find it rather surprising that trained lawyers prosecuting criminal cases wouldn't know the existence of that statute. Isn't that a fairly common?
Yes, it certainly is, and that's one of the first things that your client wants to know if you are negotiating a plea. So criminal defense attorneys are and certainly should be well aware of the effect of Act 93 because everybody wants to know that. If you're going to negotiate a plea, they want to know when is the earliest possible date that they could be released. I think that we could show at a hearing by putting on attorneys that this kind of advice is extremely important during the course of representing your client when negotiating a plea. I think that we could prove that rather easily, and I think we could show that if an attorney misadvises in this manner, that it would be a breach of a duty owed to the client and a breach of diligence, which was a term, I think, used in Strickland v. Washington. We are asking for a hearing here where, on the allegations in this case, that the advice by counsel is not speculative in nature, but positive.
The testimony of the prisoner at that hearing would be just as it is set out in your brief, that is, that he was misadvised.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the lawyer, suppose the lawyer says, no, that's not so, contrary testimony. What have you got except a debate, a decision on credibility?
That's where it would lie at that point. That's what you would have.
Well, except the lawyer's dead.
That's correct.
I'm speaking of the general run of cases that you'd make out of this.
That's right. It would simply be the lawyer's testimony against the petitioner.
Well, that wouldn't be the end of it, even if you believed him.
Well, you would have to, that's correct, in that you would have to show that he wouldn't have entered the plea unless.
Wouldn't the ineffectiveness claim really boil down to the same issue as the voluntariness of the confession?
Yes, I think so. The voluntariness of the plea.
Of the plea, yes.
Yes, I think so.
Did the state ever raise in its defense of this claim the provision of the habeas rules that allows dismissal of habeas where the delay in bringing it has prejudiced the state's ability to defend against the claim?
No. I would like to point out that the initial circuit court pleading, which Mr. Hill filed, which he styled a motion for correction of sentence, which talked about what he understood that the plea was supposed to be, was filed prior to Mr. Patterson's death. I would like to say what time I have left for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Very well. Mr. Attorney General.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Facts in this case are simple and direct. It is true that Mr. Hill was charged with murder one and theft of property, but it is also important to this record to remember that on April 6, 1979, the defendant in this case entered into a plea agreement. In that specific agreement, it is which the plaintiff knowingly waived, and informed waived his constitutional rights to a trial, to confront witnesses, to testify on his own behalf. That document, executed by the defendant with the help of his counsel, in fact, is a form in which they complete together. On that form, the defendant entered zero as to prior convictions, filled out with assistance of counsel. That same day, the defendant and his counsel appeared before the trial court in order to enter his voluntary plea of guilty. The court inquired as to the terms of the plea agreement, specifically if it was accurate, specifically if the defendant had relied upon any promises, threats, or other offers from the prosecution, specifically as to whether the defendant was satisfied with representation of counsel, and specifically if the defendant had any other comments that he would like to offer to the court. The defendant said no. I submit to you that the central issue in this case.
General Clark, just so I can find it in the record, the plea agreement is the one on 28 and 29 of the joint appendix. And where is it that he says no as to prior convictions? I didn't just want to be sure I can find it.
Your Honor, on the plea agreement, it is a form, and there's a space where it says prior convictions. There's
well,
a space
would you just tell me where it is in the record so I can look at it? Is it 28 and 29?
Yes, sir, it is. It is not.
And where is the part about the zero?
In the second paragraph in the first sentence, Your Honor, you are charged with a felony and with zero prior convictions. That zero is not underscored, but it was a blank on the plea agreement itself, Your Honor. The central issue I submit to this court in this case is whether the Court of Appeals erred in finding that the petitioner was not constitutionally entitled to an evidentiary hearing in a collateral attack of his voluntary guilty plea. I submit to you that the Court of Appeals did not make error. This court on several occasions has emphasized the validity and the importance of plea bargaining process and likewise stated for the plea bargaining process to work, a guilty plea must be accorded a great measure of finality. And in this instance, the truthfulness and the accuracy of this guilty plea, this voluntary guilty plea, is evidenced by the record. I submit that, generally speaking, parole eligibility is not a direct, but rather a collateral consequence of any guilty plea. It is unnecessary to advise the defendant who desires to plead guilty as to parole eligibility. And that the fact that the defendant is misadvised does not in itself per se negate that voluntary plea. In fact, we have found with the Federal Criminal Rules of Procedure, Rule 11, that we have stated in the comments that not only is the question as to advise as to when someone might make parole, be parole eligible, but whether, in fact, they should. And that is true in Arkansas, as there is no requirement to advise as to parole eligibility. In the case at bar, the record clearly demonstrates, I submit to this Court, that parole eligibility was not a part of the plea bargain, and that this petitioner was not wrongfully induced to plead guilty based on some assertion. I would further submit to this Court that a better rule of law is that even if the defendant was ill-advised or misinformed as to what the precise eligibility is to be for parole, that fact alone does not take away from guilt or the desire to enter a plea of guilty. There must be some demonstration of prejudice. The need for
General Clark, just yes, sir. I got it on my mind. Does the record tell us anywhere that we might have missed as to what the nature of the Florida conviction was, when it occurred, what the offense was, and so forth?
Your Honor, the record does not. The offense, however, was aggravated assault and breaking and entering, but she was convicted in 77 and served until 78, at which time it came to Arkansas.
I see. Thank you.
And the cops knew that when this plea bargain was going on.
Your Honor, I do not know that the government knew that. The
have you ever seen the government negotiate without a rap sheet?
Your Honor, I have not, but in this instance, the rap sheet that we had came from the Arkansas State Police. Whether it was complete or not, I do not know. The allegation, the need for finality in the criminal justice process is imperative, I submit to you, particularly when those challenges come from some collateral attack some years later, and are on the allegations of ineffective assistance of counsel. This allegation has become a very common vehicle for those incarcerated to seek relief by simply placing the system and their attorney on trial, while realizing their position as petitioner, at worst case, is merely the status quo. I voluntarily entered my plea of guilty. I made an informed decision to waive my rights and was sentenced, but maybe I can receive a more favorable sentence later if I will file this collateral attack on that sentence. In particular, I submit to you today, what troubles me about this case is that the so-called inducement to plea asserted by the petitioner is actually only that individual's unilateral expectation, an expectation which rarely, as in this case, if ever, can be tested by any objective standard, and which submits virtually every guilty plea, and in Arkansas there are some 10,000 entered each year, to attack collaterally at any time when the defendant, upon incarceration, determines that his expectation, whatever that may have been, that he would be denied a right to vote would not have occurred, or been denied a right to hold a hunting license or a barber's license would not have occurred, that he asserts then that because of his expectation, he can collaterally challenge the voluntariness of that plea and be entitled to an evidentiary hearing because of his own individual expectation. And this instance has been stated to the Court clearly. A competent and dedicated and respected public defender, now deceased, cannot be heard as to what, in fact, did go on in terms of contradicting or supporting the petitioner's case. But in this instance, we have a record that demonstrates that that competent and dedicated public defender, who, in my opinion, did know the law, saw from the defendant an assertion that there were zero prior convictions. And that just gave good advice.
General Clark, on page 16 of the joint appendix, there begins what apparently is the state's response to the federal habeas petition, and which appears to be a transcript of the proceedings before the district court, or at least the state's version of what happened before the Arkansas trial court. And on page 18, the paragraph towards the bottom of the page, after the indented observation where the court says something, and this apparently is the state's paraphrase of what it says, the trial judge then stated that petitioner would be required to serve at least one-third of his sentence before becoming eligible for parole. Now, is that contested in any way that you know of by opposing counsel?
No, Your Honor, it is not contested by opposing counsel, as I know of. I would further submit to this Court that though I recognize there will be those who would appear at this bar and argue that the parole is the only factor to be considered by a defendant in pleading guilty, when do I get out, if you will, that a better rule of law and policy requires that you take into consideration two very important factors, and those are simply these, and must be remembered and balanced against that assertion: the multiplicity of imponderables that can affect parole, not the least of which is the conduct of the defendant, or changes in regulation or policy, perhaps by policy-making bodies. And I submit that is in this case, when this petitioner pled guilty voluntarily and in an informed way waived those constitutional rights that are protected and was sentenced to 35 years, which was the agreed recommended sentence, he is not, and I repeat, not constitutionally entitled to serve anything less than 35 years.
Are there any circumstances, in your view, when an attorney's erroneous legal advice on parole eligibility could rise to the level of establishing ineffective assistance of counsel?
Your Honor, I've considered that question carefully. It would be my opinion that perhaps you could make the case where the erroneous advice was such an inducement to the plea, and on the record the defendant indicated that this was a material fact to the court that I wanted the material that I wanted the court, this court to consider, and therefore, if the court did not consider it, you might make such a case. But in this instance, the record is devoid of such an assertion.
Have to undermine the voluntariness of the plea.
Yes, Your Honor, I think it would have to undermine the voluntariness, as I determine that voluntariness to be the informed waiver of those constitutional rights.
Well, what if the defendant's lawyer just advised him that, parole is available, usually if you behave yourself, it'll be one-third, and it turns out that for this crime, parole just isn't available at all, true of some crimes.
Yes, sir, that is, Your Honor, it is. In that instance, if, in fact, because of that representation, and it was an inducement to that plea, the defendant thinking he would make parole when, in fact, he could not, you may have prejudice that attaches that allows such a hearing.
If those were the facts in this case, would you say that he was entitled to a hearing or not? I thought your submission was that misadvice about parole really shouldn't amount to a constitutional violation at all.
It is my submission, Your Honor, that misadvice does not amount to a constitutional violation unless prejudice attaches in some form. That is, there was no voluntary waiver.
But you would say, if the facts in my example were the facts of this case, would you say this gentleman should have been given a hearing in the?
The facts of your example, Your Honor, is that there would be no parole, but he was advised there could be parole. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Then perhaps in that instance he's entitled to a hearing. Yes, Your Honor.
In the district court on his application for habeas.
Yes, Your Honor. In summary, this court, I would submit this, that the policy, as I have stated, which is a better policy, is one in which the defendant is not constitutionally entitled to information as to parole eligibility, and that the need for finality of judgment should continue to be accorded great weight in a measure of finality when a voluntary plea is challenged on a collateral attack in terms of petition for habeas corpus. For all those reasons, I submit to you that the decision below should be affirmed.
Counsel, if a sufficient allegation were made to justify the holding of a hearing, what standard do you think should be applied, legal standard, to determine the issue?
Your Honor, I think that standard would be.
Do you agree it should be some adaptation of the Strickland standard?
Your Honor, it should be some adaptation of the Strickland standard, not necessarily the Strickland standard as to an adversarial proceeding. I think that standard is that in this instance, the defendant was induced to make a decision that shows that it was not an informed waiver because of facts upon which he relied, either demonstrated by the prosecution or by the defendant or by the court in those respects. And it's not the same test as Strickland as to that adversarial nature of a full litigation in terms of a plea of not guilty and trial. Thank you.
May I just ask one other question?
Yes, Your Honor.
I must confess this keeps troubling me. Your plea statement says you're charged with a felony with zero prior convictions. And you've told us, Professor, well, maybe I shouldn't ask it because it's off the record, the conviction was just a year or two before. And this was after 4 months after the plea of not guilty. There were some pretrial proceedings. The plea was changed and so forth. Is it conceivable that neither the prosecutor nor defense counsel knew this fellow had spent a year in jail right before this incident?
Your Honor, it's possible, although I don't know that it's probable.
It seems improbable. To whom should the zero prior, should we hold that against your opponent or against your ear? I just don't know.
Well, it didn't say zero, did it?
Your Honor, he entered a zero into the form. The form has a prior convictions as a blank. There was a zero actually physically written in.
Oh, and he?
By the defendant and the defendant's counsel.
I see.
Prepared by them. Thank you.
What should the state do if it knows that that's wrong and the state is a party to the plea agreement? What if the prosecutor had the rap sheet right in front of him and knew there was a prior conviction, read the agreement, knew the defendant had entered the wrong information?
I think the prosecutor as an officer of the court would have a duty to inform the court what the correct information was, Your Honor. Thank you.
Do you have anything further, counsel?
One matter, Mr. Chief Justice. In regard to the plea statement form, I think perhaps we need to talk about that for just a moment. In that space where you have a blank for prior convictions, I believe the purpose of that, and I think probably what happened here, is to enter the number of prior convictions if an individual is charged under the Habitual Offender Act. I don't know that we can conclude too much one way or another by the insertion of a zero there. I think the language reads
it. You don't dispute that it was who put the zero in?
Well, we don't know who put it in there. I would imagine
The Attorney General says that the defendant and his counsel did.
I would imagine counsel did that and then presented it to his client.
Imagine it. I mean, you don't contest that statement, do you?
No. No, I wouldn't contest that. I don't know who actually lifted the pencil and put it in there.
No. But you don't claim the prosecutor did.
No, I do not. No. That's all I have. Are there any further questions?
Gentlemen, case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next.